Welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick, and Chris Lucian is my co-host. And today we are very, very excited to have Johanna Rothman today. And we're going to be talking about all sorts of agile stuff and management stuff. So management and how it has to change to support agile organizations, collaborative management work, and creating a system of work that works. So before we jump into the topics, Johanna, do you want to introduce yourself, please?
Sure. People often refer to me as the pragmatic manager because I'm all about stuff that works. And I admit I'm a management geek. I am not a command and control management geek. I am a much more, not so much hands-off, but work on the system management geek as opposed to work on the people. If we work on the system, people are responsible enough to do the right thing almost all the time.
Nice. Yeah. Right on. Well, great. So how can management support agile organizations?
So one of the things I really like about your show and all the mobbing that I know from experience that you guys do is the fact that when people collaborate together on one thing at a time, they're able to finish that, get the feedback on it, and then figure out what to do next. I often say, get the next thing, but sometimes you're doing an experiment, which means you need to get data, not the next thing, right off the backlog or reevaluate the backlog or anything. And I find that I work like that in my projects. I sometimes release books early, which is always a scary thing for me, but I do that to get feedback. And so the more feedback I get, the better the book is in the end. So I have a small team that I work with differently depending on where we are in the process. So that's a different kind of a project than a software project. And I find that management often needs to work similarly to the way I work with my books. Not exactly. There are many decisions that if we could get managers to mob on them, we would be in much, much better shape. So anything to do with a project portfolio, for example, right? You guys have all seen this, maybe not in organizations that you work in now, but the managers want data. God only knows what data they want starting in September, right? September 1st through October, they ask for data, which is often, what's the backlog? What's the estimate? How many pieces of capital equipment will you need? Will you need other software tools? Questions that are almost unanswerable at the time that the managers are asking for it. Then the managers, so the teams run off and do all that data gathering. Then the managers meet in October or November, often several times separated by a week or two, and they almost always ask for more information. We don't like that estimate. What if we took away these requirements and gave you these instead? And they do this perpetually, but not continually, all the way through December. They realize in January 1st or 3rd or 5th that they need to make a decision. They make a decision February 1st, and it's wrong by Valentine's Day. That's a case where if managers mobbed on this decision at any time, at any of these times, they would be in much, much better shape. So that's why management collaboration for me is such a big, big thing. The cost of delay, the delay for decision making affects every single person in the organization. So why? And it's different than mobbing on a product, right? Because this is kind of mobbing on a decision.
Yep.
Yeah. And you might not even be able to make the decision in one meeting. You might say, I do need some more information. But then how could you get to the decision-making point sooner?
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. I think you know, a lot of it is, you know, having the right people there, right? And all of the right people there, and then getting the decision made quickly. And so when we come out of that, we can actually, we can get the feedback and really understand the ramifications of that decision. And a lot of it, you know, I also like this idea of just iteratively, you know, reviewing the results of those decisions and then coming back and saying, maybe that was the wrong decision early, right? Because I think a side effect of what you do, what you described there is by February, the decision's wrong, and by March, the decision is double downed on because there's so much of an investment, right? The sunk cost fallacy plays in a deep way. So I really like what you have to say there. What did you, I guess when you encounter this, this series of decision-making, in a group of managers, or maybe you talk to people about it with this problem, what advice do you give them to get out of that habit? You know, how do you break the cycle?
So specifically for the project portfolio, I actually ask them questions that I don't mean in a nasty way. And so I often have to say, I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions that you might feel uncomfortable with, and I'm not picking on you. Right. I am asking these questions because as I gather data from my various clients in various industries, they tend to answer these questions in the same way. So the first question I ask is, did the estimate really make a difference to your decision?
Yeah.
And often they say, well, we thought it would, but then the estimate was so wrong that it turns out not to have been useful. So I say, would you like a different metric that might be more useful instead of the time-based estimation, right? Mm-hmm. That people generate from the requirements on up. And they say, oh my God, yes. So I say, you actually have cycle time. Mm-hmm. And you can count, right? You can count the number of stories a given team does in a week or two or four, right? Not every team can finish stories every day, which kind of breaks my heart. And not every team can even finish a story inside of 2 weeks. But almost every team can finish at least one thing in 3 weeks or a month. So you count. And then they always ask, but the stories are all different size. I said, yes, and? And then I explain a little bit more about cycle time. And that's why counting stories is almost as good as measuring cycle time. And you don't have to have all this estimation refresh that makes everybody kind of crazy. And that would allow you, if you want to know that a team does six things in a 3 month period, you can wait for those six things and then change your mind every 3 months. They say, oh, wow. Right. So now I don't have to talk about cycle time in that way. I don't have to talk about the theory of flow or flow efficiency or any of that. I can explain it to them in ways that matter to them. So
it's not a buzzword bingo that they immediately check out on. And yeah. This is a conversation, and I totally agree that having that conversation on a regular basis and talking about things that went poorly in the past can then result in getting people over that hump, I think. I wonder, once they see that the cycle time, like what's the reaction of these people when they see that cycle time and start looking at different metrics, like if what was happening before, did they have quality changes? Did they have, from a perspective of management, how did they change? Is do you have any stories about that?
Oh God, yes. Yeah. So there are two cycle times often managers think about the team's cycle time. And they say, you know, our teams, they're smart people, but they can't estimate to save their lives. Right. So I talk about, I live in a suburb of Boston, and I'm not sure if you guys know about our traffic. We have horrible traffic any time of the day or night, right? The only thing the pandemic has been good for is that rush hour is much, much easier. So when I have to go into Boston, I always leave an hour for my trip. It should only be 25 minutes. It has taken me a full hour, including the parking. So yeah. So what's my average cycle time? Average is probably 35 minutes. Average means nothing in this context. Because if I'm late for a client meeting, it doesn't matter that on average, I would have been there in plenty of time. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't talk a lot about averages, but I talk about a lot about how long does a team take in work time? How long does a team need in wait time? Mm-hmm. And when they realize, once a week, I often do a little bit of measurement with the teams, and they say, the work time really was our estimate. It took 6 or 7 hours, just as we thought, but our wait time was 4 days, right? Because they're waiting for this person to come off of that task, this person to come off of that task. Right? So everybody's split as opposed to working together. So the managers all say, oh, gotta work on the team wait time. And I say, let's just measure your decision time, that cycle time. And what I often find is that the managers spend maybe 20 hours, right, on the project portfolio decisions, because they're really hard decisions. If it was easy, you know, maybe one person could do it, but it's the tension of what do we want to do as part of the organization. Not an easy decision to have. And then, so it's 20 hours of decision-making over 1,500 hours of wait time. Mm-hmm. And that's when they say, but you counted the weekends. And I said, I don't know how to not count the weekends because you didn't make a decision, right? Time is continuous. I don't know how to take out the weekends here. Yeah. That's elapsed time. And that's when they say, oh, this is the same O as the programming O.
Yeah.
Oh, right. That's what we do when we program our test. It doesn't matter. And that's that when managers realize what their actual work time for decision and the wait time, that's when they start to say, we could work on our system first. Oh, that's hard, Johanna. That's hard. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I really love this concept. Maybe it's been out there before, but it was the first time being put in my mind, is that like a management or management team, instead of them delivering a product, they're delivering decisions, and then there's wait and there's cycle time and there's all those same things on it. And that's fantastic. And I love that flip. And what you mentioned was one thing about how collaboration helps. How does managers collaborating help with their own decision cycle time?
So one of the big problems, I'm just going to keep using the project portfolio because we all encounter that, is how do we know which decision is the right decision to make for now for the project portfolio? So you guys both know in software, as we create products, the faster we can change our minds, the more flexibility we have, right? So that's one of the things I explain, whether or not I'm teaching managers about the system or the project portfolio. And then the next thing is, how do we make it so we can bring everybody together about one purpose, one goal for the organization? This is where a software team often has a better focus than a management team. And way too many management teams, right? There's OKRs, and these are not really OKRs, right? They're really MBOs, management by objectives, that cascade down to the various managers. And each manager is supposed to, quote, deliver their thing this quarter or this year, which is not the same as everybody else's deliverable, right? Mm-hmm. So if the three of us were in managers in one organization, I can guarantee you, unless they really think about an agile approach, Chris would have different deliverables. I would have a second set of deliverables. And Austin, you would have a total third set. And that means we are not collaborating because we have different measures that people measure us by. That's a huge problem. So the faster we can reevaluate the project portfolio, the easier it is for people to collaborate.
I see. And so it would cause us to maybe fight more as opposed to, you know, work together for a common goal, or, you know, whether we're intentionally wanting to fight or not. And I guess I can start to imagine as well, if there's dependencies between taking on the scenario that we're all three managers now, that I need something from Chris or Chris's team for me to make my decision. But Chris needs something from you, but then you need, so we have, and I'm starting to wonder, is it like the same wait cues that you see in code review between like test ops and dev and everything else? And so I think, I guess I can see how quote unquote mobbing management or collaboration, we can all come together and then get what we need at that moment and hopefully come to a decision to have a faster cycle time. And I guess my follow-up question is, maybe two. One is, how do you get people to want to start collaborating? Is it basically what you just said before with, you know, you ask them certain questions and they start to see the problems of their own cycle time, or is that usually the starter?
So it's partly that, but it's more often I have to work at the level above the project portfolio team. Mm-hmm. So I actually ask, I start with the project portfolio team and I say, first of all, do you realize you guys are a team? And they all say, huh, yeah, maybe not, but maybe. Okay, we get that part. Then I say, what's the strategy for the organization? And I hear, we're gonna be number one at this and we're gonna be class A at that. And I say, that's not a strategy, right? Who are your primary customers and how do they want you to work with them? And when I start to ask those questions, and you will recognize this from all the product stuff that you do, right? These are the same product questions kind of cascade down. And if you think about the portfolio, it's really, how can you get the idea of who do we really work for? Right, we don't really work in any organization. It's not the stakeholders that we work for. That's an outcome of delivering great products to customers who want to buy them. How do we deliver great products? We, God forbid, empower the teams. Right, we trust people to do a good job, and we select the projects and the services that we need so that customers buy our stuff and pay us, right? So that's when I start to think about how to frame that. That's when I actually ask people, what's the purpose of the organization? What's the overall goal? What's the overarching goal? And when they start to answer that question, they often say, okay, if I can protect my bonus, right, the rewards in the system, then I am happy to collaborate with you. But don't ask me to give up my bonus, right? So Chris or Austin can get theirs, because that's not fair. And that's totally right.
Yeah. Actually, you know, it's kind of reminds me. So I used to be in an organization where the bonus was distributed based on performance. And in that organization, it was people were pit against each other. It would even come to the point where only one person would get the entire bonus pool, because everybody else didn't deliver except for this one person. And so, and the amount of toxic behavior that spawned out of that was just tremendous. And then in contrast, I think, environments that have, a bonus policy around the entire company, unanimously, that has, I see a lot more collaboration. It's really interesting. And then you reminded me, I think recently I was part of a meeting and it was a number of managers and they all had a dependency on another group that was outside of this group of leaders. And they all had requests for this one group. But they were all prioritized only by the individual, right? Not prioritized against every other priority that this group had. Once they basically said, okay, we're going to put them all in a single priority queue and you are going to just take the next most important thing and go do that. Then things started kind of chunking through the system a lot faster and they're shocked at how quickly these things get done. And it's because this other group's not trying to divide, five or six pieces of work against five or six, and so that queuing time and the waiting time, it can really kill the productivity of an organization. I totally agree.
Nice. And one follow-up question I had was, so let's say you've convinced me and Chris to start collaborating, I'm like, fine, I'll collaborate with this guy. What does that look like? As far as a pattern goes, or, is there something you start with? Is it a meeting? Is it a meeting that happens more frequently? Like, what does that look like, day to day and kind of practical steps, since you're the pragmatic manager?
So the way it's partly meetings, but it's also, how do you get to a decision faster? And when do you rethink the decision? Mm-hmm. So, well, in product development, we iterate over features. Mm-hmm. I'm really thinking that in management, we iterate over decisions. Now, not every week, right? Especially if you're talking about things like the project portfolio. For really agile organizations, maybe once a month for the project portfolio. Most of my clients really need a couple months to 3 months worth of, we either have experiments or we need, our customers cannot actually update that fast or don't want more features that fast. I mean, this is really all about the customers. So we can stop working on this piece or this product right now, move to that product, whereas this one is in a good state. This is released. We have somebody managing the customers and the customer experience, right? We understand what's going on there. Now we can maybe do another experiment over here. So it's about how fast you need to make a decision about which things and how fast could you iterate on them and make that worthwhile for the customers. If we think really about the customers, right, that laser focus on the customers, I think we're much better off.
Gotcha. And I'm guessing from what you're saying earlier that it's not like, me and Chris are going to, so to speak, management mob every day, because that might not match the cycle of the customers. But our efficiency should be higher, so in the sense that we get it done in one go, so to speak, the decision and the gathering of data and that kind of thing, where, instead of like, oh, I sent Chris an email and then I'm waiting. And then, that whole wait queue is that you come together, you try to get as many items as you can in that, whatever your meeting frequency is, as opposed to being apart and pinging each other.
That ping pong is bad everywhere, right? Long email threads.
Email in general can be toxic, but people don't realize it, right?
Nice. Okay, cool. So in one sense, that is almost kind of like mobbing, right? So it's kind of more like a, what did they call it out there in the community? Flash mobs, so people who get together for a little bit, work on some open source, get some features done, and then they're away for a month, and then they'll meet again next month or something like that. So it's kind of more similar to that cycle. Yeah. Okay, cool. So I think, so I had two more questions, but I don't want to dominate. Chris, you got any questions?
Oh, no, it's just looking like time might want us to switch, but go ahead and ask your questions. I think we're good.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, maybe I'll, you're right. We do have another topic we'll have to get to, so I'll jump to that. But maybe the one I'll ask first is, yeah, let's actually switch to that last topic, because I think that kind of will lead into my other question. So what we might consider to create a system of work that works. What do you have in mind here?
So in the Modern Management Made Easy books, I have 7 principles. And I talked about the overarching goal and the purpose. Well, I kind of mushed them together. But I find that a lot of managers don't realize how little they can do to and actually enable the people doing the work. My experience is senior leadership has their hands into middle management, which has their hands into first line management, which has their hands into the teams. And I know, and by the time the teams have all this micromanagement, the teams are saying, well, you go ahead and write the code. You go ahead and write the test. Yeah. So instead of that, I would really like people to build empathy and trust. I find that when we trust people to do a good job, and they might need some boundaries. I've worked in regulated industries where, I mean, you need to make sure that when you get your audit, that you pass your audit, right? This is, otherwise you're not in business. So there are often boundaries or guidelines or constraints, but they don't have to be the kind of overarching constraints and really making a box for you to work in that's so uncomfortable. So really trust and empathy and catching people succeeding. I really like, you guys know me enough. I have received feedback my entire life that I am too blunt and direct. That is a characteristic of me. It's not something I can easily change. However, I started to change a little bit about my bluntness and directness when I got feedback that said, Johanna, I really like how you framed that conversation. You made it easier for people to understand what you meant. And you didn't, they actually said this to me, you didn't piss them off in your explanation, right? So that was catching me succeeding at something. I did not know how to manage my bluntness and directness until then. That you might think, you know, you're an old person, Johanna, you should have figured this out earlier than about 20 years ago. No, it took me that long. So because somebody caught me succeeding and gave me reinforcing feedback, I was able to start changing how I speak. Do I still kind of piss people off? Yes, I do. Yeah, I'm a lot more conscious of it. And even if I start going down that path, I can often catch myself and say, wait a minute, did I just irritate you? And if the colleague says yes, I can say, let me rewind that. Let me apologize, rewind, and say it again in a way that might not irritate you as much. And because I can then use a little humor, they have more empathy with me and what I'm trying to say, right? We are creating a better conversation in the moment. And that business of catching people succeeding and empathy and actually making it safe for people to disagree. This psychological safety is a huge thing. I bet you've seen teams where people tried to mob, but they were not able to have conversations that might not be blunt and direct the way I am, but they couldn't even say, I don't understand that. And if you cannot say, that's not even I disagree with it, or I see three things wrong with it. If you cannot even say, I don't get it, I don't understand, you are not going to succeed as a mom.
Yeah, that's 100% true in that. I love what you said. You know, it seems to be the same psychological things applying in the kind of management circles and on the code kind of more mob levels, in that kind of modeling vulnerability, like you said, right? Like you catch yourself in the middle of being blunt or
irritated
or causing irritation, you know, whatever you're doing, causing annoyance and being like, you know, I'm sorry about that. Let's try that again. Can we rewind? And yeah, I think humor helps a lot with that. And yeah, I think modeling that can really bring down people's walls and seeing that like, oh, well, she messed up and, you know, she's trying again, or she doesn't know something. So maybe it's okay if I say I don't know something. And yeah, you're right. Without that, it kind of just stalemates. And it's really hard to move forward. And I really love what you said about catching people in success too. That's something Chris has been coaching me on coaching lately, is reinforcing positive things. And so, when you catch it happening well, it can really mean a lot to someone to turn up the good, so to speak. And this really did tie into my second question I was going to ask. So it sounds like your tactic is you kind of start where people are at. They might have command and control structures. They might have such and stuff going on. And I remember reading in your book, you start to hint at self-management and trusting people to get it done. How do you kind of help? So it kind of, correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like self-management to a degree is a certain goal that you think would be good for organizations. Is that true?
So all of us manage ourselves outside of work, right? We have families, whether or not we have a partner and children of our own, we are responsible to other people in the world. We often have mortgages or rent payments. We somehow get ourselves clothed and fed and to work every day, if not almost every day, right, on time. We are not going to talk about my boring clothing, right? I excel in boring clothing, and that's totally fine. But we are responsible to ourselves, we are responsible to other people in our private lives. Why do we think that somehow when people walk in the virtual door or the physical door, that they are not responsible to their team and to the organization? Why do we think that they can't take responsibility? My experience is that people want to take responsibility. Every time I hired somebody who was new out of school, they were so gung-ho. They really wanted to succeed. They wanted to make a difference in the world, and they wanted all this responsibility, and I was certainly like that. And maybe I tried to bite off more than I could chew, but I really wanted to do a great job. And I don't know how many people you've seen 5 and 10 years out of school who say, I like work. Yeah, work is good. Yeah, it's not where I get my excitement. I often do this other thing outside of work. That's really where my heart is. And at some point, I will turn my avocation into my vocation. And while that might be true for many people, I still think that we could make it even better for people if we allowed that responsibility, right, that people want to take. Dan Pink calls this autonomy, mastery, and purpose. That came from Edward Deci. I think that's how he says his name. Yeah. Only read the words, not heard them. With the internal motivation stuff, we are internally motivated for almost anything. And as long as managers stop demotivating people, we are much more likely to get the outcomes that we want. So that's where I really, to me, that's a piece of this system of work.
Yeah, and I think I've seen a lot of that where, you know, people come into the industry and then slowly the light leaves their eyes, right? The excitement leaves, and you know, to the point where people just treat it as just a job, and then their, you know, their passions leave, you know, but yeah, it's probably, you know, I think especially in software development, people didn't, you know, most people I think didn't study computer science because they thought it would be like just a good job, but they hate programming, right? Like it doesn't make sense to me, right? Because like there's a lot of other vocations that people could go into that they could just purely chase the money, right? But you know, even though software pays well, I think that, you know, there's passion behind everybody's desire to be in software development. So I think especially it's an interesting thing, because I think that people in general, it's safe to assume a software developer came into the industry with a passion for computing and a passion for software and making people excited by automation and, right, all those things I think can be assumed. And so if you assume that, everybody that's disenchanted with their job right now probably went through this cycle of, very likely that management on some level kind of overmanaged them and destroyed their vision of what work life might be like. And it's a very dangerous thing, because you can lose most of that person's productivity, or you end up like firing people. A manager might end up firing somebody because they're disenchanted, and it's really maybe not, it's not the fault of the individual. A lot of the time it's going to be the system that they were in that just took all the passion away, right?
So I think that I'm really persuaded by your vision of self-management. How do you, what's the next steps for managers who are trying to make this transition? What do they do who are used to, so to speak, micromanaging, or what we might call micromanaging? Maybe they didn't call it that. What's their first steps that you help coach them through?
So the first thing is to figure out, what am I doing? How do I learn to see myself and see how I am with other people? And I have some suggestions for that and practical ways to manage yourself. But it's a lot of asking the hard questions. How many decisions do I need to be involved with that the team makes on a regular basis? So if the team, so we all know that software product development, is a series of little tiny decisions every single day by every single person on the team, right? If you're mobbing, you tend to make those decisions more collaboratively. And if you're only pairing, I would love it if more people paired, even if they didn't mob, right? Then a pair makes those decisions. But we all have to somehow organize ourselves to make these decisions and agree with them. If the manager feels the need to be involved with all of these decisions, oh my goodness, that's just, it takes all the passion out of it. I got into software because I had never had so much fun solving problems before, right? And I am an old programmer. So 1974 was my first experience programming. So that totally changed my life, and I'm thrilled that it did. So the first thing to pop back up the stack is see where you are with your decision-making and how you treat the people on the team, and how can you say I'm wrong? Can you say I made a mistake? Can you say I don't know? The more you can say that as a manager, the more you give permission for other people to be able to say that, which allows for much freer ideas and freer working together, right? So there's all that stuff. And then the next step is to make sure that you actually look for the harmonic whole, that the team should work in flow efficiency wherever possible, right? So work groups such as HR and customer support, they are groups, not teams. They're not gonna work in flow efficiency. However, you can make it easier for them to make more independent decisions or work together to understand the decisions that each one of them made, right? So there are many ways to, I'm going to say this word again, empower. But every time I say empower, if we substitute trust for that word, I think that that's a better way to say it. So how can we trust the people to do a good job? And then, of course, the third is management innovation and working as a management team at all these various levels.
Fantastic. Excellent. Well, I'd love to keep chatting here, but we're coming in close to our time box. So before we close out the show, is there anything you'd like to share or plug?
So sure. I'm going to plug my Modern Management Made Easy books, Practical Ways to Manage Yourself, Practical Ways to Lead and Serve Others, with Manage in parentheses, and Practical Ways to Lead an Innovative Organization. They're out everywhere in ebook and paper, and I don't know when the audiobooks will come out because, no, audio right now. Yeah, fine.
That's awesome, though, that audiobook's coming out because I'm a big audiobook fan, so that's great.
Well, I've seen that I have different readers. Some readers only read ebooks. Some readers only read paper. Some readers only read audio. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's me. I'm definitely an audiobook aficionado. Doing dishes, I want to be learning something. Or vacuuming, I want to be learning something. That sort of thing. So it's fantastic.
I'm the same. Yeah.
All right.
No.
Well, to all of our viewers and listeners, please like, subscribe. If you know somebody that is a leader in an organization and really maybe needs some direction or maybe you're somebody aspiring to something along those lines, then I definitely recommend that you share this or know somebody that's in that wants those things. And maybe that'll help the world kind of with better management. So until next time, we will say bye to you all. Thank you.
Thank you.